I'm going to give the next program a discrete interval, and this would be a good time for me to play my theme as outro music, because, once again, this is not our maiden voyage, but just a shakedown cruise, and it's been so good to hear from you tonight. And let me try a little bit of technical magic here. I'd like to be courteous, you know, and close to time. And let me see how I might do this. Okay, we're running at 27:45 according to the clock here. And if I actually do this, all I have to do is take 15 seconds to say, thank you for listening tonight to Earthwatch, and you waited very long. You've got the last word.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I figured, I know
it's... You got about 30 seconds.
Be closing. I just wanted to mention that I had actually had heard on the Tom Hartman show, The Big Picture, that they are holding, organizing on freespeech.org.
Mm-hmm.
To organize a huge campaign for the third-party candidates. And they're holding a big conference.
Okay, just tell us where to be in touch with
it. I believe it's freespeech.org, and I had called Tom Hartman's television show.
Oh, okay, okay, that's enough.
And spoke about BAI.
Oh, good for you. Send me an email to...
I don't have a computer. The radio.
Well, then write me a letter. Robert Knight, WBAI, 160 Convent Avenue, New York.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much.
And for those of you who are digerate, take a minute to think about going to the website rootsaction.org and tell them who you think should have or not have a Nobel Peace Prize. Thank you for listening tonight. Coming up next, Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. Thank you for listening and helping my... maiden voyage, reach fulfillment. Thank you. I love you. I'm alive. The station is alive. And because of that, we can all be better.
When will we all stop and see? When will we find what we've been missing? Man in the moon must have found, 'cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine, light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? Light of truth we won't let shine. Life, there's still a day, and I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
I'm on? What do you mean I'm on?
Oh. Yeah. Backstage.
I'm on, he says. Well, you know, first of all, I think it's rather presumptuous. Second of all, oh, dear. It's good to see you in person, man.
And, you know, I'd love some second all. Oh, I'm sorry.
The second of all, which is the new version in which they've cut out all the useless part.
Oh, okay.
You know, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, and users don't need the useless part, right? Or something like
you'd
that, which means that
you'd
you
be
know,
surprised.
Which means, which means that you know that you're tuned to listen to sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York.
Okay.
You know,
I
like this console better than the old one. I don't. Arms are
some
only.
Some of the cue clues are different, and the phone system acts illogically. But here we are.
Yeah, really. Yeah, exactly. So let's see. So I've got this. I've actually got my theme music on my keychain there. I've got to figure it out, and there it is, good.
Oh, what key? What key?
A minor.
That's some Stevie Wonder fingertips.
Yes.
Also, Fire Sign Theater.
Oh, this is frisky.
but that's really great, one. Mm-hmm. Mrs. President, the point being, you see, that you take the list of seven words.
Oh, right.
That's it. So all you have to say is, my God, how can you be such a five? Or
three you.
Really, really, you know, and that's how it works, because people know the list of seven words, right? So all we have to do...
SPCCMF, actually, I differ with the order.
Not that they mean...
People like us, we know these things.
Yes.
We're Batman.
Darn straight. But people like us also know...
What is actually playing on the radio at this moment?
What you're hearing.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, no! Bye!
Take care, Robert. Good seeing you. Okay, well, and given all of this insanity, you know that means that you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, New York City, WBAI, vibrating 99.5 million times every second. Yeah, I did press it. It's just slow. There we howl. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With me this morning, one of our most important guests always, Richard Bowes, reading a fairy tale and from the all-time classic, Minions of the Moon. Thank you. and good morning. This is, as mentioned, WBAI in New York City, and we are broadcasting. Again, I can't get quite used to the idea, the fact that we are broadcasting from Harlem, from CCNY. And let's just say that the move from Wall Street to CCNY is a major change in the life of the radio station. Yes, Rick?
I would say so.
Yeah.
Major social change.
Yeah. Now, I am not a person, being a high school dropout, used to the university environment. Not that I've taken in much since I'm only coming in here so far late at night.
Well, I've spent most of my life, even though I have absolutely no interest in education, I've spent most of my life around universities. That's true.
Yeah.
And libraries, too. And
yeah. At the same time.
Yeah.
Because you were...
even though I never learned to read.
That's an amazing thing. Do you get somebody to read the stories you write to you? Is that how it works? You buy the audio books of all of your work, and that's how you...
That's how I do it.
That's how you proofread them and stuff? Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Well, we don't talk about proofreading. That's a,
oh, okay. Yeah.
That's a sad and terrible subject.
It really is. Proofreading, copy editing. Ah, yes.
You know, punctuation, all of those
punctuation,
things.
Punctuation, yes. Once upon a time, they also had looms. You know,
that's before my time.
Unfortunately for a lot of our listeners, proofreading and punctuation were probably, and grammar, is before their time. So,
well, yeah, I have no use for punctuation.
So we should, for those who have not heard you on this program before, how many times have you been on the show now?
Goodness, I don't know.
I think we're easily into double digits.
Oh, more than easily into double digits. It's been over the last, I think it was when I was pushing Minions of the Moon in its original incarnation.
That's right.
That I came on when here. That would be about 15 years ago.
Yeah, Kevin had already been collected into one volume at that point.
Well, that was what Minions was. But yeah, I think I was on here in like 98, came out in 99, but I think I was on here in 98. And mm-hmm. I've been on a couple of times a year ever since. So
yeah.
I think we're more than in double digits.
Yeah, and on some of my most important shows.
That is true. That is true. The first one that you did in the new time slot I was on.
That's correct.
Yes. Yes.
That was very intentional on my part.
That's right. It was Thanksgiving morning at 1:30. I came on and read something totally inappropriate.
Yeah, I had considered having you on the first program out of these studios, but you were unavailable.
Really?
So yes, I had spoken to you, so I got instead Terrence Taylor.
A suitable replacement.
Well, yeah, he also, it was a pitching morning. You know, it was a lot of begging for money.
Groveling.
A lot of groveling.
Which I like to do. I like to grovel, but usually it's for personal gain rather than...
I was going to say, please, I don't need too much information, but that would be a good joke for Terrence anyway.
Terrence is great at this. The only problem is he's so beautifully dressed, and you can't see that on radio.
Oh, you didn't see the Twitter picture I put out of him? I got a really nice photo of him. I got a really good one of Daniel Jose Older last week. If you
yes.
want,
yeah, well, he's again. You miss a lot on radio.
I will be taking one of you while you read this morning. You are forewarned. I also am now taking 360-degree photos, which guarantee I won't be in them because I'm at the center of the fulcrum. Well, I'm in a swivel chair.
Taking the back pictures of the back of my head. I don't like those pictures.
No. It's from the inside out that
the
I take.
The inside out.
Yes.
Oh, there are going to be pictures of my inside. Well,
I don't have the guts for that joke. But anyway, tell us. For those people who haven't heard
have not yet heard my expound upon the wonders of me, I mean,
who is you anyway? Who am us? Anyway?
Who am I? Well, my name is Rick Bowes, and I...
But the byline is Richard.
The byline is Richard, yes. And
but,
I don't
but
know
you
why
answer
I
to
did.
Rick.
Everyone calls me Rick, yes. Except members of the family who call me Rick.
Even your website calls you Rick.
Even my website, especially my website. But yeah, and I write speculative fiction.
By the way, I just have to tell people there is now, finally, after all these years, a MargoAdler.com.
Right. Well, that's good.
I'm currently designing it. There's a placeholder
and
there.
She never, no one calls her Marge, I'm sure.
Ah, no.
No,
no.
She's Margot even to her mother.
Margot with a T, yes. But I'm sorry, go on. It's just been how many years, and she's never had a website.
Well, all good things must come to an end. But yes, I write speculative fiction. I have written a whole bunch of stories, and I've written some novels, which in some cases are made up of stories. I think the first story I wrote didn't get published, but I think there have been 67 since then, and they've all been published.
Wow.
Yes, it's amazing, and says very little about the taste of editors.
A great deal. You're sitting in the self-deprecation chair. Switch over to the other chair and boast a little more.
Oh, the egomania chair?
Yes, exactly. Yes, that's the proper right. WBAI chair. Self-deprecation
right.
chair.
Some of them, you know, it's... But yeah, it's been great. I mean, most people have more common sense than to keep on writing short stories, but...
Well, there is that problem, yes.
It's a transition thing at this point. I mean, there are people whose careers are mainly as short story writers still.
Yeah,
not
but then
the
it's
only
hard
one.
To have a career. I was talking about this 3 weeks ago. My guest was Ken Liu, L-I-U, who's...
Well, Ken Liu will eventually write novels. And
he's under contract. For
right.
One.
He'll yeah. write novels, and that will be what happens to Ken Liu. But
he professed a love...
Oh, they all say that. They all say that until they find out what it's like to write find out what it's like to write a novel and have people actually pay attention to you. And at that point, their love of the short stories goes by the wayside.
I mean, given that last year he won the Triple Crown,
he did, and that certainly brings you to. I mean, certainly he deserves it, and it certainly brings you attention. And the nice thing about winning awards. Is that 100-word bio, biblio, that you have before each story. You know, Rick Bowes has won 2 World Fantasy Awards, a Lambda Award, and blah, blah, blah. And you can
no,
do
don't
that.
Blah, blah, blah. Tell us.
Well, it's 2 World Fantasy Lambda, the Million Writers Award, and the International Horror Guild Award, which is no longer with us, but which I won before it went away. And I was nominated, oh, God, for any number of nebulous.
The Lambda Award is
for the best gay.
Not gender-bending, but specifically gay.
Gay. In this case, it was, best gay speculative fiction novel, basically. And it was for Minions.
Happy Stories. Happy oh, the stuff. Other gay, sorry.
Well, you know, it's no, I mine was not of the happy variety, but...
No, they seldom are, Rick. I've noticed that.
No, there
were
some. The one
stories.
I'm going to read, the fairy tale I'm going to read is a happy story about dressing bears. But
that's B-E-A-R-S.
B-E-A-R-S, yes.
Okay, I just thought I...
Well, yes, it's...
You know, given some of the topics we've covered...
Well, it's... Anyway, yes, the thing about the Lambda Award, because it is a gay award, it's a very nice little award.
By the way, who gives that out?
The Lambda Association thing. It's they have magazines, and it's a gay literature foundation at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And they give out a whole slew of awards, you know, best lesbian play and that sort of thing. And each year, and they... have done a lot to publicize gay lit, basically.
So it's not specifically
it's that was the thing fiction. That was the thing that I liked about it most was that it was not a spec fiction award specifically. I mean, this was that award is for speculative fiction, but that the organization itself was not part of the genre,
mm-hmm.
And that I liked. The
it raises it a level.
Well, it also.
raises McHugh's, the recognition
McHugh's
level.
China Mountain Zhang, which I really think is the best.
Maureen game. McHugh, yeah.
Maureen McHugh, I'm sorry. Yes, right. Maureen McHugh.
Yeah.
China Mountain Zhang, which I think is to me the best gay speculative fiction novel. I had won it a few years before I did, and that made it more important.
That's
for
a superb novel.
It's a stupendous piece of work, and it captures. It's kind of amazing because it comes out in the 90s, I think, and yes, was it
early 90s?
Yeah, early 90s. But she captures very well in a future world and with a protagonist who is a Chinese kid in America, an awful lot of what it was like to be a gay kid in the 1950s in America. Mm. And so she does that very well. I was quite impressed by that. Mm-hmm. You know, that everything has to be a secret, but the fact that it's a secret also makes it this wondrous thing that you...
And that's also an era that you commonly return to in many of your stories.
I do.
50s and 60s.
I do. Well, it's practically, at this point, the 50s and 60s are practically historical fiction. You know, you Mad Men, I just watched an episode
Do me a favor, by the way.
Yes.
I don't often ask this of you. Wear headphones, and you'll know why after you put them on, because you will realize that if you so much as touch the desk, it makes this
thunderous sound. Like that. Hey, that's
nice.
Isn't
that cool? Isn't that nice?
It is nice.
Yeah, Daniel and I were like doing tunes last week, yeah.
Well, he's irrepressible that way. But yeah, I've lived long enough to see my childhood become an historical period. And
I'm leaning there. Born in 53, so awareness begins in 60. So
it's that is fine. But yes, I do return there. I mean, it was in the 60s, basically, that I achieved whatever amount of self-realization I was going to achieve. And I do write. I have a novel in stories coming out later this year called Dust Devil on a Quiet Street, and it's 14 stories. Most of those are at least on some level gay stories. But a lot of the stories that I write aren't actually gay, and one of the, I mean, I suppose everything I write is gay because I'm the one who wrote it.
Well,
but yeah. But about a month and a half ago, Aqueduct Press brought out a collection, a very small collection, very beautiful book.
It really is. Thank you for the copy.
Why, you're
you
welcome.
You gave me to bribe being on the show. I didn't know this was coming. It's gorgeous.
It is a beautiful thing, but they're modern fairy tales. And
yeah, you'd read one the last time you were on the air, which is what, about November?
It was probably about November, yeah. And
before or after Sandy? It's just before.
I think it was before Sandy.
Yeah, just before, because we were off the air after Sandy.
Yes, that's right. Must have been before. But it was, that was Seven Smiles and Seven Frowns, and that is basically a fairy tale about fairy tales.
Yeah, and we talked a lot about the number seven.
A magic number. 3, 7, 9 to some extent is a magic number. Those are the magic numbers.
Yeah, and 9 because it's 3 threes.
Yes, and also, well, there are other reasons I won't go into on the air.
Yeah, but the Queen, the Cambion, and 7 others.
Queen, the Cambion, and 7 others is the Aqueduct book, and it's available from Aqueduct itself. It's a little cheaper if you buy from them, but it's also on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and everything else. It's the Queen, the Cambion, and 7 others.
Mm-hmm.
And I
wonder what they call their conversation pieces. Which
one
is...
of that, yes. And you notice the one that came out before mine was Chris Barzak, who was the one who introduced me to Aqueduct.
Ah, okay.
And basically...
Ah, there we are. Okay, Birds and Birthdays.
Yes, it's a terrific book. I think Aqueduct has brought out about 80 books, and I think only 4 of them have male authors. And
yeah, Cherie Renee Thomas had a piece in here, Rachel Swirsky. I noticed there's a piece on Joanna Russ and radical truth telling. And I remember Joanna when she lived in New York. So.
And she was into radical truth telling, certainly. That I do remember.
yeah, but a lot of what she was into when she lived in New York was not the way that people think of her today. No.
Well, I think this is true. I mean, the legend overcomes the actual writer.
Yeah.
I mean, the Philip K. Dick that one knew and, you know, had perhaps seen in his lifetime is not the Philip K. Dick we celebrate today.
Yeah, right. Very true. The last... we have a tweet from Bulgaria...
Yeah.
Saying the last time was indeed November last.
By God, sir. So it was after Sandy and...
Tap here to reply by voice, okay? 1 second. Thank you, Bobson.
Thank you, Bobson.
Okay, now, is that cool?
That is stupendous, and I feel I'm connected to the world, if not the universe.
Well, I mean, that, instantaneous communications from Bulgaria. I think it just cursed. Oh, is that message sent? Okay. I have to turn off the
volume. Well, that has always been my dream, was to have instant communication with Bulgaria.
I think there are some governments who felt the same. I'll put it on vibrate, which is some other people's dream.
Really? Well, that's a dream that can become reality easily enough. But
fairy tales.
Fairy tales. Let's get back to fairy tales. Let me read a fairy tale.
That would be Marvy.
I think it would, rather than going on uttering obscenities here on the air. I think we should elevate the level here. This is from The Queen, the Cambion, and Seven Others, and it's a very short fairy tale. The Bear Dresser's Secret. Early one morning, Sigistrix, the bear dresser, left the Duchess and her castle. He gave no warning before he slammed the golden tricorn hat, the sign of a grand master of the Animal Dressers Guild, onto his head and picked up his suitcase. He gave no reason, though as he walked through the gates, he did remark to Grismerelda, the Duchess's young maid, "A bear dresser answers to no one." She watched the many snowy egret feathers on the Grand Master's hat flutter in the breeze as he disappeared into the dawn. The Duchess was having her hair done when they told her. "Faster, faster, silly girl," she said. "Today is a disaster, and I must look my very best." Every morning, Grismerelda spent hours getting her dressed and ready. "It's just like a bear dresser to leave like this. Dear grandfather, Fernando the Mad, would have known how to handle him." She enjoyed reminiscing about her distinguished ancestors. Who among us doesn't? She summoned her chamberlain, her guard captain, and her jester. "You see what must be done," she told them. "The bears have no one to dress them, and the great fair is 1 month from today." "Yes, your grace," said the chamberlain. "He never looked trustworthy to me," said the guard captain. "Take my life, please," said the jester. "We have entered our bears in the animal costume competition from time out of mind, and with a few highly regrettable exceptions, such as occurred last year, we have always won first prize, and we will continue to do so. Sigistrix has always dressed bears for me," she said. "His father dressed them for my father. His grandfather dressed them for mine, except for those times he escaped and had to be brought back in a cage. These things were much more easily handled in the old days, before they had laws. I expect results from you three by this evening, or I will be most annoyed," said the Duchess. And you all know what that means. Indeed, they did. The three were deathly silent for a moment. Then the chamberlain cried, "Gentlemen, to the bear's house." Meanwhile, the bears themselves, large and small, brown, black, and white, were at home dressed in their natural fur. "Good morning, bears. Always lovely to see you," said the chamberlain, and kissed several paws. "Tenhut," said the captain. "Funny thing happened on the way to my beheading," said the jester. "But, though they worked hard all day and ruined several satin cummerbunds, a dozen pairs of silver slippers, and a tailored tweed skirt, the bears were not dressed at nightfall." "This will never do," said the Duchess. "My godmother, the Countess Ferluccia, would have had you all beaten soundly and hung up by your thumbs." For weeks, the three men tried to dress the bear. Every morning at breakfast, it would start. They begged them to put on elbow-length gloves. They tried to wrestle them into velvet knee-breeches and satin farthingales, and did high-step cakewalks to show them how fine it was to wear dancing shoes. Each evening, the bears still were not dressed. Everyone was very unhappy. One day, the Duchess decided to dress the bears herself. "I, Her Grace the Duchess, command that you all become dressed," she said. But nothing happened. "I shall close my eyes, and when I open them, you will all be dressed." When she did, nothing happened. "I shall give each of you a jar of honey." Nothing happened, though the bears liked honey very much. Uncle Rodney of the Bloody Hand had an instinct for dealing with stubborn animals. He once had a pig put in stocks for failing to bow to him. The bears wandered away, just like bears. "Come, Grismalda must go and dress for lunch." And she stamped back to the castle. That evening, while getting the Duchess dressed for bed, Grismalda asked a question that had bothered her. "Your Grace, how did Sigistric dress the bears?" "It was an old animal dresser secret handed down in his family. Mind the comb, silly girl, it's pulling my hair. You're fortunate I don't mind that as much as my dear mamma did." Grismalda hardly dared to ask the next question. "Your Grace, might I try to dress the bears?" "Silly girl, you have no experience dressing bears. You have only dressed me." But next morning, when the bears were still not dressed, the Duchess remembered her maid. "Young Grismalda wants to dress the bears. Let her try." So, that morning, after dressing the Duchess, the maid set out to dress the bears. It was long and tiring work, since bears are very hard to dress. Shoes, for instance, even open-toed sandals, are extremely difficult because of the claws, and about silk stockings and bow ties it is best not even to speak. By the end of the day, she had managed to wrestle the smallest and most cooperative bear into a sundress. "That," said the Duchess, "is not good enough. I will give you one more chance, and if you fail, I will be forced to do to you the very thing second cousin Honoria did with the footman who dropped the butter dish." Next day was the same. Although the bears were fond enough of Grismalda, who would sometimes bring them honey, they remained impossible to dress. She knew the Duchess would be displeased, and her mother had told her the terrible tale of Tom the footman and the troublesome butter dish, and how he had walked strangely forever after the thing that was done to him. She took out a handkerchief and wiped away a tear. Every bear picked up a handkerchief, too. Grismalda stopped crying. She even started to smile. "Oh, bear," she said, "thank you very much." And she reached down and picked up a hat. By dinner time, every bear, from the oldest in a battered French yachting cap to the youngest in a broken propeller beanie, was wearing a hat. "Not enough, silly girl. Whoever heard of prizes for just wearing hats?" asked the Duchess. The judges last year called the bears' hats lacking in presence. Still, I suppose it is something. "Your Grace," said Grismalda, "I will have the bears dressed and ready for the fair, but I can do no other work. No one can bother me. No one can watch me. If you agree to that, the bears will be dressed, I promise. One does not make deals with me. Why, I remember the presumptuous tailor who dared to offer me a dress so fine only one of my rank could see it. I could, of course, see it, and was appalled by the shoddiness of the material. His thumbs still hang over the fireplace in the autumn parlor." She paused, then said, "Very well." Only next day did she wonder who would dress her. Next day, bright and early, Grismalda went to the bear's house. She waited until she had their attention, and then she picked up a shoe and put it on. It took a while, but by that evening all the bears were wearing shoes. Meanwhile, the Duchess was dressing herself. Often she was surprised by the results. Her hair was a wild tangle. Birds thought to nest in it. In the ancestral closet she found a turban. It had belonged to the Caliph Mustafa the Damned, a distant relative. He had lived in the castle briefly after he was exiled and before he was drawn and quartered. She put it on her head. "Grismalda, bring me my mirror, silly girl," she cried, before remembering that Grismalda was far too busy. A week later, her maid returned and said, "Perhaps, Your Grace, we would do better in the competition if the bears had better clothes. Wherever would we find them on such short notice, you insolent child?" Grismalda pointed to the Duchess' closet and said, Later that day, as they opened the 10th or 11th trunk, the Duchess gave a little cry of recognition. The seashell-embroidered four-piece bathing suit belonged to Nadine the Necklace, Countess of Lith, first lady of towels at the imperial court. The Duchess hesitated before handing it over, then said, "She married my great-great-granduncle and was an in-law, so you may take that." And those very long-tailed shirts belonged to my father's distant cousin, Sir Douglas the Pantless, a disgraceful relic. Take them. But you can't have that tasseled silk strangling scarf. It belonged to my dear mother, giggled the Duchess girlishly. She used to threaten everyone with it. I shall wear it in her memory, tied around my waist. Oh, and my dear papa, the Duke's tiny branding iron. He would heat it over a candle and sear his crest into the behinds of people who fell asleep at dinner. I'd forgotten about it. Those green galoshes with the frog's head on the toes, on the other hand, looked just right for a bear. Such a large size, I can't think who they were for. And a box of garter belts with the ancestral crest and amorous gargoyle on each. There were enough for each bear to have one. Bright and early in the morning of the fair, the bears were dressed in picture hats and silver cuirasses, and silk tutus and velvet knee breeches, and patent leather slippers and flowing silk ties. Old Father Bear stuffed his feet into cowboy boots with silver spurs. The most popular event each year was the animal costume competition. Every aristocratic house participated. That year the crowds were larger than ever, and there were many contestants. Among them were the elephants of the Countess Borzuki, with a new Celtic dance routine, the swans of the Marquis de Cruel, on roller skates, and last year's winners, the lions of Prince Nasty, wearing shoes with mirrors on them and wide-brimmed picture hats lined with lighted candles. But this year, these seemed like vulgar gimmicks. Everyone agreed that the bears of the Duchess in their remarkable wardrobes were in a class by themselves. The chief judge turned out to be Sir Gistrix. He smiled as he awarded first prize to the Duchess, who seemed overwhelmed. Then, on Grismerelda's head, Sir Gistrix placed the copper tricorne of a master of the Animal Dressers Guild. It bore a single egret feather, the sign of a first-place finish. From then on, the bears dressed themselves, and at the castle, the Duchess dressed herself. The Duchess never learned Grismerelda's secret. Uncle Phineas, the unwashed, did something quite horrible as a lesson to a servant who kept secrets, said the Duchess. But she was too busy trying on the many-armed hunting jacket that had once belonged to her godfather, the Elector Conrad, who was nicknamed the Octopus, that she couldn't remember what the horrible thing was.
Bindung ein. Egal. Solange man nicht betroffen ist.
It's not bears, but it's a fairy tale.
Long ago there were three pigs, little handsome piggy wicks. For the big, bad, very big, very bad fools, they didn't give three figs.
Number one was very gay, and he built his house with hay. With hay, hay, tea, tea, blue as flew, they played around all day.
Number two was fond of jigs, so he built his house with twigs. Hey, diddle, diddle, he played on his fiddle and danced with Lady Pix.
Number three said nix on tricks, I will build my house with bricks. And he had no chance to sing and dance, cause work and play don't mix.
Ha, 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 the two little doo-little pigs just winked and laughed, ha. Who's afraid of the big bad wolf, the big bad wolf, the big bad wolf? Who's afraid of the big bad wolf? La, 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 la.
Came the day when fate did frown, and the wolf blew into town. With a gruff puff puff, he puffed just enough, and the hay house fell right down.
One and two were scared to death of the big bad wolf's breath. By the hair of your chinny chin, I blow in, and the twig house answered, yes!
No one less but number three to save the piglet family. When they knocked, he fast unlocked and said,
come in with me.
Now they're all safe inside, and the bricks heard wolf's bride. So he slipped down the chimney, and oh, by jiminy, in the fire he was fright.
Who's afraid of the big bad wolf? The big bad wolf, the big bad wolf. Who's afraid of the big bad wolf? La 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 la.
straight from the Weimar Republic, or wannabes from the Weimar Republic, Max Raab und der Palliser Orchester. They're wonderful.
I was going to say, I think that song is one of the very few popular songs from the United States earlier part of the 20th century written by a woman.
Really? Who wrote it?
I can't remember her name because...
Was it written for Disney? Was
yeah,
it?
She yeah. was. And the other song that she had, the other standard, is the Willow Weep for Me, was also...
Ooh, and that's a good song.
It is, it's, as is Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf, much little different genre, but...
A different genre, and one became sort of an anthem for an era.
Right. That was a Depression song.
Yeah.
Quite definitely. The other one...
Which is why it fits so perfectly with this orchestra, this German orchestra that specializes in songs from the Weimar Republic.
Right. She was...
There's a play or show, a cabaret show, opening up with songs from the Weimar Republic. And I'm trying to remember who it is. It's not Uta Lemper. It might be B.B. Newworth. It's somebody of that ilk.
Huh. Something or other. Well, wasn't there a movie about club kids in Nazi Germany?
It was awful.
Yeah, it was dreadful, but I think there's going to be another one.
Oh, hopefully they'll do better than that.
Yeah, that was really bad.
You know, discovering jazz in Nazi Berlin.
Right.
It was... Not when I say that it was fictional, by saying fictional, I mean that it has its history non-existent. It you know, its history is all wrong.
Yes, and, well, it was a musical.
some musicals. There are no musicals that take place during Nazi Germany times that are accurate, except maybe The Producers, but...
Right, no, it's not a place for musicals, basically.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, Weimar is pre.
Well, cabaret, you know, ends basically with the.
Yeah.
Ends
yeah,
with it, the. Ends with the Weimar Republic. It's not. I mean, musical comedy, whatever it is, Rodgers and Hammerstein did for them, is a successor to operettas, and you know.
I have to. Crank the door open a little so Lister can come in when he's ready. Only when you're reading. Because Rick will be reading again, and then we can't have the door open. But outside of that, hey, Lister, outside of that, we have to, enable the next show to come in. Sorry.
Well, that's true. You can't lock the next show out. That's an old adage of radio.
Well, not true here at WBAI.
You shouldn't lock the next show out.
I know. I'm the one who opened the door during the broadcast and shouted to Max, "Open! Open the door!"
It might be worse. You might be locked in.
there is that.
I go to DPRK.
I was locked out last week for 15 minutes. I could not get in here, and that may have been a blessing. I'm sorry, but go on, Rick.
I've forgotten what I was going to say.
No, Weimar.
No, the Weimar Republic. Yeah, it's not, you know, even the Weimar Republic isn't a big subject. Outside of cabaret, I can't think of one that touches on it.
I like the songs of the time. There are some very good documentaries, actually. There's a lot of existing film.
A lot of
including of the cabarets.
A lot of interesting footage. There's the movie I Am a Camera, which, because it's the issue with material from which Cabaret was later made, is, you know, it's an American movie and doesn't catch the thing at all.
Well, they wouldn't capture the real Christopher Isherwood in the year that movie was made, would they?
Well...
What year is that film?
I don't know, about 1950, I think.
Yeah, so they would,
You mean the gay aspect of it?
Yeah, I mean the
gay
aspect of it.
Well, there was a lot of, what was it called, the Alfredo, whatever it was that Proust did, in which everybody in Remembrance of Things Past is gay, except the narrator, Swan, who is Proust. Now, of course, Proust was gay,
but
it's Albertine, the Albertine strategy. And he has a mistress called Albertine, but in fact, his chauffeur, Albert, was the person with whom he was making whoopee. So you can always do that.
That's my middle name.
Albertine?
Whoopi. No, Whoopi.
Oh, Whoopi.
No, it's Albert. It's Albert.
Jim Albertine Freund.
Well, that can't be that much worse than Jim Albert Freund, right?
Jim Albert Freund. It's not. That's a good name.
I don't know. I've had it for a few years now.
My middle name is Durain, so that my last middle name and last name is Durainbows. Somewhere over Durainbows.
Oh.
No, really, that was pointed out to me.
So you're a Yip Harburg lyric.
I'm a living Yip Harburg lyric.
Well,
really, having done
Oz,
that, you know,
Oz is in vogue right now.
Well, you know, having done that to me, my parents couldn't understand how I became gay.
Although very often the parents, well, anyway. Well, depending on
many
the shrinks
things
we're talking about. We have a little time here. It's 2:13.
Yeah, I don't
but
know
actually,
what time we go off the. I keep expecting the sun to come out somewhere
whenever,
outside the window.
Yeah, because that would be the hour of the wolf, except for the fact that who can tell here? We're in a. You asked me yesterday at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings whether there were windows here, and I said.
Well, yes,
no.
There are.
Well,
there are windows. They look out into other rooms, but there are windows.
Yeah, I mean, yes, there's a window that looks into a studio, which looks into another studio, and that.
Ad infinitum. What floor are we on?
Basement, I guess. I don't really know. It's the ground floor. We're level with the sidewalk.
Well, that is good, I think. You should never, you know, above your station.
Well, and speaking of above your station, the station is WBAI in New York City.
We're all above that.
Yeah, and I'll tell you the one major complaint I have, and it's something that nobody can do anything about. You really can't get a good phone signal in here. On the other hand, this place has the best Wi-Fi I have ever seen in a building.
That is.
It's like build. It's all
education.
Over its building.
That is the sign of an educational institution.
Yeah. Okay. All I know. Yeah. So I get actually great connectivity, and therefore, given technology, I can make phone calls over Skype and this and that. But I can't use my phone as a phone. It's very strange.
Well, the only place in NYU where you can't use this is the gym. Because people were taking candid photos of other people.
That you cannot do. It was probably a very good idea not to enable.
I thought really was quite a, you know, too bad. But
I knew which side of the issue you were going to fall down on that one.
No, I didn't think it was fair at all to do to people.
Oh, you mean the candid photos?
The candid photos.
Yeah, exactly. They should pose.
Yes, absolutely. And be paid. And,
well, exactly. That's a whole other issue.
That's
a whole
right.
Other
I mean,
issue.
You know,
and that's over in room 301.
Well, I mean, I sympathize with that, certainly.
Yeah, now you know about universities. I haven't met anybody here proper from CCNY. And, you know, initially when we're told we're going to move here, everybody said, oh, you're going to CUNY. No, it's City College of New York as opposed to
City University.
City University and City University.
CCNY
is, a whole,
is what we're
yeah,
at. Right.
Yeah, but CCNY has nothing to do with CUNY, correct?
Nothing, no.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Are there any other campuses than this one in Harlem? Or are we?
Well, wait a minute. No.
Oh, wait. There is. There's a place like on 42nd Street,
well,
right?
No,
a graduate center.
There are plenty of parts of, plenty of sections of CCNY around the city.
But this is the main.
This is the main campus. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, this is New York City is well provided with municipal and state universities. State university system of New York is very fine.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And we know any
it's located and located in all those awful places upstate, but it's still at the.
But we know, but it employs a lot of good science fiction writers. John Langan.
That is true. Yes.
There are a few other. Well, Joanna Russ used to be at SUNY Binghamton.
That must have been something.
You and I know somebody in your writers group, in one of your two writers groups.
That's true. Who works? But he's at
she.
Oh, really?
Barbara was
she,
at.
Oh,
SUNY.
She was at SUNY. Yeah,
she was at SUNY Binghamton at the time. Joanna Russ was teaching.
And
at
what
SUNY
was it
Binghamton.
Like?
It was like she couldn't get into the class.
That's right.
But you know, the funny thing is, I could. I did, because I went up.
Disguised as a woman.
I went up disguised as a hitchhiker, actually. I think I went up with Jack Dan.
Who was disguised as a woman.
And a couple of other people. We stayed at Joanna's house.
Oh.
And I would sit in on some of her classes. So I actually got to sit in on more of her classes than a lot of SUNY people who wanted to go in, because I was a high school dropout. So.
That's right. Well, that is a distinguishing market.
And we won't even talk about my career teaching college, which I've done in two schools, but after being a high school dropout,
I don't have a GED. The great imposter has nothing on you. Did you ever practice medicine or any of those things?
At one of them, I didn't lie. They just never asked.
And the other one, you did lie.
The other one, which was a CUNY school.
You lied.
I lied.
You lied through your teeth.
I lied through my teeth, and they did a very simple thing. They let me continue teaching the class, but it was no longer an accredited course. No problem with that, right? As long as it's not an accredited course.
I have no problem with it, certainly.
Well, that school, which will remain nameless.
What school was it? It's going to remain nameless? All right.
Veronica Shanus teaches there, okay?
Does she really?
Yes. Okay. So now people can triangulate and figure it out
the whole thing. Yes. Well, yeah. I do know.
And actually, there's any number of decent spec fic writers who teach at CUNY.
Well, you know, decent spec fiction writers are like a waste of time. What you want is the indecent ones.
No. That speak for yourself, Rick. Let's put it this way. What would entice you as being indecent, and what would entice me as being indecent? Entice is the key word here.
Entice, really? Why is that the key word?
I don't know, because I can't spell it, maybe? Something like that. I don't know. Speaking of which, tell us a little about Kevin.
Oh, Kevin Grierson. Kevin Grierson.
How's that for a segue?
It's really enticing, Kevin Grierson. Grierson, to some extent, is me. His life more or less follows mine, but with a lot of differences in the particulars. There's a story that I did recently. It's for a Steve Berman anthology, Where Thy Dark Eye Glances, which is queering Edgar Allan Poe. It's Edgar Allan Poe stories done, but with gay content, which, believe me, in the case of Edgar Allan Poe, it's he meets you more than halfway.
Evermore.
Even though it's apparently the one thing he never did in his life. There is no evidence he practices. But anyway.
We should mention the name of the press.
Letha Press.
Yeah. And my guest next week, by the way, is a writer who has a book out from Letha Press, Catherine Lundoff, recorded last week or week before last.
A Lethean, huh? Well,
there's a good term, Steve, if you're listening, and
He complains that everybody mispronounces the name.
Letha?
Letha.
Do I not have it correct?
It's the way I pronounce it, but we may all be incorrect. How do you pronounce it?
Lethium.
Lethium, yes.
Lethium. Okay, lethium. Well, that's the thing that's the pill you take when you get anyway.
Yes, that is when you become too much for your own good.
It's the battery in my phone. It's the lithium battery.
That's right. Well,
Steve, remember that you could have a tie-in. You could have a very big commercial tie-in with lithium batteries.
I'm sure he isn't listening.
Gay batteries.
He's asleep at this point.
No, I don't think so.
But anyway,
he's been tweeting.
Has he really?
Yes, he has.
Well, So that, yeah, that was Kevin Grierson, and I created 10 stories, and they became Minions of the Moon. I have returned to that time and place, and I have returned to, you know, stories. The parts of it that gave me the most trouble writing were the parts where Grierson is a child and an adolescent, because there were too many things from that I had managed to forget that I then remembered while I was writing it. The parts that, the latter parts of the book, which are his, he's cured of addiction and alcoholism in that. So those came more easily, and those were the first ones that I wrote, actually. It was On Death and the Deuce was the first story, and that's Grierson is hiding out after he and his shadow, he has a doppelganger, and he and the doppelganger have pulled a robbery. They've ripped off kids who were in town to buy drugs, and they have just held them up at gunpoint and stolen their money, basically. And he's hiding out in Hell's Kitchen, and he is in therapy with a man named Leo Dunn in the book, who was in real life was Vincent Tracy, who was the addiction and alcohol counselor to whom I went. And those parts of the story, there were like four or five stories that I wrote around his recovery. Those parts were relatively easy. The parts about the childhood and adolescence were really sort of painful. And I'm going to read, when I get around to reading, I'm going to read a section from that part of the book, from when Grierson is a kid.
Do you want a break first, or do you want to dive
Let's
in?
Let's break. Let's take a little break, and I will clear my throat and prepare myself and run through the scales. And
okay, hold on for a second, and let's see if I... How about some more Max Robb?
Max Robb is certainly what everyone deserves.
Oh, here we go.
At 2 o'clock in the morning, 2:25 in the morning.
And whatever time it may be in Berlin at this moment. Okay.
Did we get it?
Got it.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm going to have to recue that for a particular reason I'm not even going to discuss, but, Yeah. Oops.
What's he doing up there?
Turn that down. Suffice it to say, we have to wait 20 seconds before I can cue that song up. You can help me with this, Lister? You know how?
Yeah, you just go like this.
Okay, this is because this is what I... Oh, look at that! Here. Thank you! Thank you!
Hast du bei Frauen wenig Glück? Ein kleiner Trick bringt sie in Liebesfieber. Sag nicht zu ihr, mein Engelein, mein Vögelein. Sag ihr viel lieber, du bist meine Greta Garbo. Bist die schönste Frau der Welt. Blond bist du wie Greta Garbo, nur hast du nicht so viel Geld. Trotzdem kannst du mit den Wimpern klimpern, wie es die Garbo tut. Gerade so schön wie sie, soll man denn wie sie, Greta Garbo aus Hollywood. Mit den Wimpern klimpern, wie es die
garbo tut. Grad so schön wie sie, so mondän wie sie, Greta Garbo aus Hollywood.
Du bist mein Greta Garbo. Und du bist WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial. You know, I'm the name is Freund. I can't do a German accent. My father was from Nuremberg.
I think it's greatly to your credit,
Frankfurt. Frankfurt. Well, maybe so. This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City. My guest this morning is Rick Bowes. I am Jim Freund. Rick is going to be reading a section from Minions of the Moon, which came out some years ago, but it's coming back into print, I understand. Rick, is that true?
This is indeed true. Letha Press, which I'm sure
it's a lithium book.
Lithium book. The Letha Press. And it Minions of the Moon came out in 99, and it was only a print version. It's out now from Letha Press, and you can buy it on Amazon and elsewhere. The changes are that it is available on Kindle. You can get it electronically. And there is a brand new Grierson story included. Grierson now. It's Grierson as an arthritic and disagreeable person rather than a drug-addicted and disagreeable young person. The other book from Letha that will be out on July 2nd is Dust Devil on a Quiet Street, and that is...
I've been looking forward to that one for some years now.
Me too.
because I've read and heard so many short stories from that book.
Yes.
Many of which are just superb, including the title story.
And some of them even kind of well known, like There's a Hole in the City, which is the first of the
which we here honor at WBAI, having broadcasted actually on the 10th anniversary.
And the 5th?
The 5th and the 10th anniversary. I'll have to line up the 15th anniversary soon.
Yeah, we should all live so long.
really, including the station itself. It's a September 11th story, still the best one that I have ever read.
And it's the best one I've ever written.
And, you know, one has to give credit to WBAI for putting it on the air at 11 a.m. on the 10th anniversary.
Yes.
I mean, that's...
Yes, it
cool
was,
stuff.
It was amazing.
And what Janet Coleman did by bringing in Charles...
a psychiatrist.
Yeah, the psychiatrist who specialized in mass trauma.
Right. No, it was great.
Grozier.
That was great.
Yeah.
But anyway, yes, that Minions of the Moon is out again in a brand-new edition with a hitherto unavailable Grierson story, and you can get it on your Kindle if you so desire. The other one is Dust Devil, and that will be out, as I say, in July. And we all, I'm sure, are eagerly awaiting it. Let me read now from Minions of the Moon. This is from an early chapter of the book in which Grierson is a teenage kid. The autumn of my senior year of high school, my shadow stepped forward for the first time and grabbed control of my life. The summer before, John F. Kennedy had been nominated for president, and my mother died behind the wheel of a car. Until then, my shadow had been vague, hard to pinpoint. I was happy to leave it that way. Sometimes I wondered if anyone outside our family had them. The only shadow I'd ever seen was my mother's, and it disappeared after she was gone. Her death hardly gave me pause. Since she had been drinking, I was convinced that, as always, my mother would show up sweetly apologizing for being late for her funeral. Naturally, I told no one any of this. The code of silence for the Boston Irish was simple. Certain things you didn't tell other people, and lots of things you didn't even tell yourself. When he came to the wake, my stepfather had little to say. His divorce from my mother, when I was 11, had been a disaster for us. Not that Frank was all that great. Usually he ignored me. What I appreciated about him in retrospect was that while he was around, we looked like a TV family. All about me, aunts and cousins broke down. Gramny, my grandmother, aged visibly. Even Grand Aunt Tay was badly shaken. I alone was dry-eyed. On one occasion or another, at the wake, each of my uncles, Bob the lawyer, Mike the cop, and Jim, who had the bar in Field's Corner, got lit and talked to me about Ellen, their little sister. She had been their father's favorite. I was the first and favored grandchild. Thomas, Terrible Tom Malloy, my grandfather, had founded the bar and the family fortune, such as it was. His sons had gone in fear of him. Jim, the eldest, shook his head sadly. They had hopes for you, Kevin, school and all. When you have time to recover, we have to think about your future. My plans included college, but otherwise were vague. I thought sometimes about a .38 caliber revolver that rested in the upstairs hall closet. The day of the funeral, Aunt Tay hugged me. I don't think anyone else has ever been called that. Teresa was her given name, like the saints, and she was very proud of it. But when, as first grandson, I called her Aunt Tay, it stuck. Even her sister, Gramny, began calling her Tay. This thin, white-haired lady, with great blue eyes, looked at me and said, "By fell night." When I was small and down or scared, we had recited this verse. Tay Fallon was a storyteller, a poet. I tried to slip by her, saying, "Come on, Tay, I'm fine." "By fell night," she repeated, and stood in my way. With a bored sigh, I gave the response, with stick and bone. "De lechdan," she said in Gaelic, which I didn't understand. It's hard for those of us with the gift. It would have surprised me if she knew I was thinking about the revolver upstairs. Tay had been born with a call and claimed a kind of second sight. She insisted that I, too, had a gift, though what it was she never said. All I knew for sure was that I lived under a kind of teenage curse. I was too smart to be a tough kid and too crazy to be a smart kid. The high school drama society was where I hid out. Maybe the ability to see and believe two completely different things is the very base of second sight. My mother had always said that she wanted her effects to be given away to charity. That fall, her sisters-in-law turned what had been her bedroom into a faceless guest room. Still, I managed to believe in one corner of my mind that she was still alive. In an Irish household of my grandmother's generation, the eldest male, whatever his age, was himself. His wishes might not be law, but every failing would surely be ignored for as long as possible. My grandfather had died before I could remember, so when my mother and I moved in with Gramny and Tay, I became himself. That fall, I strained against the ropes and found there were none. At my all-boys school, the dress code called for jacket and tie, but away from school, I dressed like a street punk, cultivated my hair, carried cigarettes, and even smoked a few. I snuck sips of whiskey at home and found winos willing to buy me half pints. At the downtown Y, I showed up regularly, but not to swim. My grandmother's house, a gray Queen Anne on the hills of Dorchester, was a minefield of memorabilia, but my favorite was that .38 hidden in the upstairs closet. Oiled and clean and wrapped in a piece of chamois, it was something I wasn't supposed to know about. At first, all I did was to take it to my room and spin the cylinder. A box of ammo was wrapped up with the revolver, but at that time, I had never loaded it. Once, I put the barrel to the side of my head and pulled the trigger. When I did, I felt that someone was with me, but when I looked, I was alone. That time, I was careless about putting the revolver back. Tay noticed. Had I been a few years younger, she might have whipped up some dark and special tea to snap me out of it. Instead, feeling I needed help, she leaked word discreetly to her nephew, Bob the lawyer. Bob's wife, Aunt Alice, who had gone to college, had a friend who recommended a shrink. Money was found to send me to him twice a week. Tuesdays after school, and early on Saturdays, I went over to Kenmore Square and talked to Dr. Charles Petrie, a fat, middle-aged guy with nubby sweaters. Tuesdays, in blazer and slacks, I told him about my school problems. The Drama Society, remember, sir? I mentioned that they're doing Shakespeare's Henry IV, Part I. I told Mr. Royce, the faculty advisor, I wanted to be Hotspur. It's a great part, this rebel who stutters when he gets excited. Petrie nodded like he knew the play. Yesterday, I found out I'm Poins, who's like this minor accomplice, and he's not even in the last act. A pause followed until it occurred to Petrie that I had stopped talking. What? Another pause. Was your reaction to that? I got real pissed. Yes, he wrote that down. Go on. His office was part of a suite shared by a half dozen other analysts. Tuesdays, there was a receptionist, and the place was full of patients, unhappy fat ladies, tense guys clutching briefcases. The entire building was busy. Saturdays, the halls were quiet, the waiting rooms empty, when I'd come in wearing a short jacket, black chinos, taps on my loafers. Petrie and I never talked about my mother, or the gun, or what it was I did after leaving the office. One Saturday, I told him, I'm in this long hallway, a sort of gallery with the soft kind of light, and these middle-aged guys standing there. One of them looks at me and says, you're twins. The phrase, middle-aged guys, seemed to interest the doctor. He nodded and wrote that down. Do you remember any more of your dream? He asked. Back then, I almost never remembered dreams. The week before, in the place I described, a guy who called himself Joe had actually said that. Looking where Joe had, I glimpsed a horribly familiar kid, giving the special hard smile I sometimes practiced in mirrors. Then the kid was gone, and Joe shook his head, saying, just seeing double. While I wondered how to explain that to him, Petrie said, time's up, Kevin. See you Tuesday at 3. Emerging from his office, I found the waiting room no longer empty. A patient with long strawberry blonde hair sat on a couch, leafing through a New Yorker. She wore pants and ankle-high riding boots. One of them rested on the low table in front of her in a way that was absolutely cool. With the dead accuracy of a kid, I realized she was a crucial few years my senior. I also knew that skin and bones like hers were expensive. When she looked up, it was right into my wide eyes. From my limited experience of lovely girls, I was prepared for her to realize our differences in age and sophistication, frown, and go back to her magazine. Instead, she nodded like she understood what she saw. That was a feeling I never got from Petrie. Smiling, she asked, what is your shrink giving you? Anything good? Not sure what she meant, I shook my head. She nodded towards one of the officers. I'm seeing Kleinman, a dullard, but occasionally useful. My name is Stacy Hale. Stacy held out her hand. I took it and told her my actual name, a thing I didn't always do. She left something in my palm. Next time, have him give you those. I looked down at a green heart-shaped pill. Texedrine, she said. You're here on Saturdays? Dr. Kleinman's door opened as I nodded. Out in the hall, I still saw her face. The pill was a little bitter when I washed it down in a water fountain. At first, I felt nothing. But by the time I reached the Y, I was sailing and ready to play what some kids called the game. Saturday mornings and a couple of weekday afternoons, they gave kids swimming lessons. We swam bare-ass, and counselors not a lot older than we were got to wear bathing suits and carry whistles and yell at us. Instructors and other adults could stay fully dressed, if they wanted. After a while, another kid showed me how to wrap myself in a towel and go through a door behind the locker room. It led to a place I thought of as the gallery. There, instead of getting yelled at, boys were treated with respect and generosity. Going there always felt like I was on a quest and about to discover something. Part of the game was staying cool and keeping your clothes. The guy in the lobby desk was used to seeing me. He didn't even look at my card or watch to see if I went to the locker room. Going there meant I stood a good chance of spending a miserable morning in the pool. I turned down another corridor. The Saturday I met Stacy, kids shouted far off in the water. In the gray-lighted gallery, middle-aged men whispered. None of my regulars was around. Some guy I didn't know said, $10. He led me to a far alcove and murmured commands. Open your clothes, slowly. Shirt and jacket off your shoulders. Let the pants fall. Pull down your drawers. Yes. Hands behind like you're cuffed. Look tough. I gave the practiced hard smile. Yes. It was creepy, standing with my all-American jockey shorts around my knees and him all clammy and cold, but the danger was a turn-on, and all this seemed to be happening to someone else. Afterwards, I bought a milkshake at a luncheonette with my winnings from the game and couldn't finish it. Inside my head, something crackled like the blue sparks on trolley wires. Gray and dowdy streets slid by around me till I found myself staring at a fence, watching an engine shuffle cars in the Boston and Maine yards. In the distance, slanting October sun hit the John Hancock Tower, and I thought about Stacy. Tuesday, in blazer and tie, I looked at Dr. Petrie and said, "You know, sir, there's this kid in school who's having trouble like I'm having. His doctor gave him a certain prescription, and it seemed to help." The drug never again worked like that first time, but by Friday, when the cast read through Henry IV, I already knew all my lines and most of everyone else's. Saturday morning, tingling from speed and anticipation, I came out of Petrie's office and found the waiting room empty. Stacy's doctor didn't even seem to be in his office. I was stunned. Out at the curb sat a red MG with its motor running. Only when the horn blew did I focus. "Hey," I said. Stacy smiled. "Can I ask a big favor?" "Anything." She must have seen that. "This is a no parking area. Could you find a place for it?" "Oh, do you drive?" I shook my head, ashamed to let her down. She turned off the engine. "Then can I ask for you an even bigger favor?" Any plan imaginable could be canceled. "Wait here, and if the cops come by, turn on the motor and pretend you're going to pull out." She tossed me the keys and went into the building, saying, "I'll buy you lunch. It will be a chance to talk." Thank you.
Más en tu idioma, más entretenimiento que nunca. Combina el.
She was a real classy broad. Well, cheer up. You still got your hair.
Yeah, and you still got your career, Mr. Graham. Just remember what the immortal Bard once said.
All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. Unquote. So remember this.
The girls today in society go for classical poetry. So to win their hearts, you must quote with these Aeschylus and Euripides. But the poet of them all, who will start them simply raving, is the poet people call the Bard of Stratford-on-Avon. Brush up your Shakespeare, start quoting him now.
Especially Henry IV.
Brush up your Shakespeare, and the women you will wow. Just declaim a few lines from Othello, and he'll think you're a heck of a fella. If your blonde won't respond when you flatter her, tell her what pony called Cleopatra. And if still to be shocked she pretends well, just remind her that all's well that ends well. Brush up your Shakespeare, and they'll all kowtow.
Rick is, of course, pointing out how these are the 1950s lyrics as opposed to the original lyrics for the movie. Yes, 1953, yes. By the way, I hope everybody at home is doing their soft shoe.
Girl is a Washington Heights dream. Treat the kid to a midsummer's night dream. If she fights when her clothes you are mussing, what a clothes much you do about nothing. If she says your behavior is heinous, kick her right in the Coriolanus. Brush up your Shakespeare, and they'll all kowtow.
Gadzooks, more dancing.
And they'll all kowtow.
Thinks thou?
And they'll all kowtow.
I trow.
And they'll all kowtow.
I think we'll leave the encore for best unsung. But, you know, Keenan Wynn and James Whitmore, my favorite, favorite folk singing duo from the 1950s.
Well,
I mean...
The one I saw as one of the gangsters was Jack Klugman. First time it was done on TV.
Well, that was with Alfred Drake and Patricia Clarkson.
Patricia Morrison.
Patricia Morrison, the real...
Kirk. Yeah. Lisa Kirk was not in it. She was in it. The one they didn't use was Larry, whatever his name was, the Hoofer, because there wasn't any dancing in the TV thing. So they had the guy, he was a tenor, he was on TV all the time.
Well, I watched a clip of it with Alfred Drake.
He's good.
He was sitting next to me.
Oh, he was with you.
He was with me.
As one with Alfred Drake.
I worked for his agent. I worked for his talent agency. I was a talent residuals clerk, and he would show up to collect his weekly checks for voiceover work or something. And let me tell you something, he looked just like Alfred Drake should look. He was this classy...
But what had happened to his career?
I don't... Well, he was doing voiceover work.
Well, he was... But, I mean, he was...
He wasn't doing on camera, but he was working.
He was as big as anything on Broadway from the time he did Oklahoma until, like, into the 1960s.
But what happened to Barbara Cook, you might as well ask? She's still working.
She's still working, but she's still... He was not respected. I mean, she's singing, and she is no longer somebody that, you know, you would want to see on stage. But he was doing, like, soap operas and stuff like that.
That's right. And tell you something. As a talent residuals clerk, soap operas pay well.
Plenty of money. But he was a producer. He was everything.
Yeah.
I mean, he owned Kismet. That was his
really?
Show. Yes.
And earning a lot of baubles, bangles, and shiny beads.
Something happened. He had always had vision problems, but I don't think that was what did it.
He saw the numbers on his checks I wrote.
I've never failed. And my father used to tell me stories about
talent
Bert
for
Law.
Actors.
Bert Law, my father was the box office manager in a summer theater where Bert Law came through. Law liked to see the money coming in. He would stay in a corner of the box office so no one could see him. And as the money came in, he would,
yes, exactly.
What he was looking for was something he could do every year, as he said, like Hampton had with Sereno.
No doubt John Lahr has written about this kind of a thing. Notes on a Cowardly Lion is a wonderful book. It really is. But since there's been so much attention paid...
He wasn't born at that point.
That's right, but he knew his father afterward.
Yeah.
And his father had a lot of stories, and John Lahr likes to tell them. And if anybody should be lucky enough to have the Smithsonian Channel as one of the channels in their TV set, and even better, Smithsonian On Demand... There's a documentary about Oz and L. Frank Baum that has John Lahr telling a lot of his father's stories, and they are precious. They really are. We have about 5 minutes left before it's time to make room for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way. But if you'd like to call up and speak with Rick Bowes, you can do so at three is our phone number. It is, oh my God, people, I don't know the phone number and people are calling. 212-650-5782 is the telephone number here at WBAI. Let's give it a whirl. Good morning, you're on the radio.
Hello.
Hello.
I'd like to say, are you related to Mr. Bowes? Are you related to the famous Bowes that did the programs years ago?
Major Bowes. No, I am not related to Major Bowes. I deny this categorically.
and a good thing, too.
And a good thing, too, yes.
Well, it was just curiosity because...
It's a legitimate question.
It is a legitimate question.
And it's spelled the same way, but thank God there's no relation.
No, I...
Well, he was famous for
Indeed, he was. Infamous, I think, is the word you're looking for.
And he, when he died, he was succeeded by Ted Mack, who had been his announcer, I think, or something.
I'd like to say that the reading was very good, very depth.
Thank you.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Very much so.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks so much for calling.
Okie doke.
Take care. Good morning. A few people were actually named. There's Major Armstrong. There are a few majors out there
The Queen Mother of England was Lyons Bowes.
Really?
It's a name, Lester. It's a common name in Leicester in England.
Ah, now, which of course isn't mixed, spelled Leicester. It's spelled Leicester or something Leicester. Like that.
How a bunch of Micks ended up with the name, I don't know. But
okay, and on that note, good morning, you're on the radio. No, you see your dial tone because that was somebody calling from Dublin.
That was somebody related to
yes,
from
no,
that part
no,
of the
that
family.
That was a Bose
the Queen
from
Mother's
Dublin.
Part of the family.
Exactly. hi there, you're on the air.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert. I knew it was you.
Okay, quick piece of trivia. You mentioned Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf. You know that appeared in an early 30s Hollywood film?
Yes. A cartoon.
More than one.
More than one, yeah.
It was in March of the Wooden Soldiers.
Yep.
Yes.
With Laurel and Hardy.
Yep.
In the scene when little Elmer, one of the three little pigs, gets kidnapped by the evil Silas Barnaby, played by Henry Brandon.
That's right. And boy, was that a performance.
There were some performances in that movie that you just don't get anymore.
Well, there's a crew.
And thank God for that.
Well, you know, it's...
Well, there's some great singing in that, you know. I mean,
yeah.
And,
no,
you know, listen, it was for the 30s. Of course, Silas Barnaby was an okay villain, but later on, of course, Henry Brandon played the wicked, infamous Dr. Fu Manchu in a great...
He did
indeed.
Did
he? Wow.
Yes, he...
With that nose, how could he avoid it?
Yeah, no, he was...
In which he tried to do nothing less than conquer all of Asia by stealing the golden scepter of Genghis Khan.
Well, that would have done it, you know, certainly. I believe what's-his-name there in North Korea has it at this point.
By the way, great story. When you were reading The Bear Dresser, for some reason I was thinking of Terry Bisson's How Bears Discovered Fire.
Just called Bears Discover Fire, How Bears
right,
Discover Fire.
Bears Discover Fire, yes. Well, I'm glad to be mentioned in the same breath with Terry Bisson.
I have to find that my recording of Terry reading that, and we'll do a
interweave.
Segue.
We'll
do an all-bear Hour of the Wolf.
And Elizabeth Bear can come and watch.
That's
it.
Right. She certainly can. And we can have Pooh and Piglet.
Well,
Bob Fass was Pooh. I was Piglet. But that's another story.
Well, that was typecasting.
It was.
3, 7, and 12 in Western tradition.
Okay, we have 60 seconds.
Yes. In other traditions, 36 in Jewish tradition, 8 and 13 in the Hungarian tradition, Russians 9 and 49, and in Native American...
And Brooklyn Nets, nothing.
George Carlin.
Yeah, okay.
And here's a
And George Carlin, 7. Okay, so at any rate, another 7, another magic 7 for George Carlin. Whoops, okay, we lost Robert there. Okay, well, we have like 30 seconds left.
Well, we could do some things in 30 seconds. But
Well, I mean, we can start the music.
Go out and
underneath.
Buy Minions of the Moon and Dust Devil on a quiet street.
Okay, and not to mention...
Oh, yes.
The Queen, the Cambion, and
seven others. Yes, be sure to buy that.
And I think the best way to do it, what I recommend, is for people to go to rickbowes.com, RICKBOWES.com. You don't have links to these?
No. I don't have sales links to the things from the... The best thing to do is to go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Okay, or one of the online... Or even to, and this is a radical, thought for a lot of people, a bookstore. If you can find one.
If you can find a bookstore, you have an incredible talent.
Yeah, you know, and you too can be used for a search.
Peaceful purposes.
Yes, exactly. But definitely, very simple. If you see a copy of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction or Asimov's, or a book with the name Richard Bowes, B-O-W-E-S, not Major, but Richard Bowes, on the cover, by all means, pick it up, read it, and stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper. The guy just left the room. He's been in here all morning, and it's time for his show, and he walks out. I don't know. Next week, another Lethian will be with us. Catherine Lundoff will, in an interview conducted a couple of weeks ago. And thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. You can visit OurWolf.com. You can visit me on Facebook in the Hour of the Wolf group, which is an open group. And, well, all kinds of stuff like that there. Rick, thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
And
it was a pleasure.
We'll do this again real soon. Good morning.
Just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Number one,
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talking about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx.
WBAI, 7 minutes after 3 o'clock, burn baby burn time, flag burning time, y'all.
We're gonna do this until when? Los Cafres, por favor, Los Cafres. 99 single list alive right here on the radio until 5 o'clock, 3. Until 5 o'clock, don't forget 5 o'clock shadow with my main man, Robert Knight, at his very best. That's why we call it 99 cinco, por favor, para ti. Yes, I am. So we do it. Flag burning time, y'all. Flag burning time. So we do it. Yeah, it's good to be back right here at 99 Cinco WBAI, where you and yours and your big fat spliff belong. Burn, baby, burn.
Music, it's so divine. It's yours and it's mine. Come on and sing with me. It makes you feel happy. Your old body move. Yourself you can't control. Just when you get the soul.
I try, but them can't survive. Come me blessed by the most high. All of them I do, all of them I try, but them can't stop I. Hear why? Evolve as a man as I unravel the deepness. Examine the evidence, decipher the secrets. Come give me the realness. Time to let go the weakness. Dangerous systems, innocent victims. Vote for peace, come make we chant on the killing. Cause when me come in, I go roll me a defend. Yes, me a defend, I may not apprehend. Time to open up, let go and venture. Not defend the love with a hidden agenda.
Yeah.
For soul takes time, so never surrender.
10 minutes after 3 o'clock, Jim Prime, one hell of a good show. As usual, right here, 99 Cinco. 516-620-3602, you did well. Hey! Hey, playing all the music they refuse to play on the reggae shows right here at Burn Baby Burn, y'all. Hey.
All of them I do. All of them I try.
Watch that.
But them can't stop I. Blessed by the most high. Time to open up, let go, stop doubting. Time to keep a focus. Beware of the bogus. For hate is a tool and passed by the fool. For love will conquer, stand up on a rule. Know your roots and the truths and rights will come. Never give up, don't run.
And we're gonna go to London, England live. David Katz, co-host of Burn Baby Burn, out to London, England, from the streets of Brixton. Kill some J.A. Heard the pigs killing one human being every day on the island at J.A. Lloyd D. Aguilar on the case.